Test.
Check this out.
Ranger.
Autonomous Action Radio, a multimedia radio show, a website, an idea, a suggestion, an action plan. Because it's up to us now.
This communique will most likely be marked and destroyed shortly after it is discovered. Listen on at your own risk.
Good afternoon. My name is Linda, and I'm here today with Peter.
Hey, everybody. Happy Easter Bunny Day.
And coming up on today's show, we're going to be hearing from the Stimulator with the latest It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, which features a interview on the history of the Black Bloc. Coming up, actually, at 2 o'clock, because today is an extended version of the Anarchy Show till 3 o'clock. Coming up at 2 o'clock, I'm going to be playing a mixtape of Fuck the Police songs put together by Nick One from the Hostile Takeover. And that dovetails nicely into today's theme on Triple Z, it seems.
Yes, sort of. Well, it's always an underlying current, isn't it, Linda? Of course. Who did the police serve? We were asking before on Twitter Radio. Well, yes, lots of answers and a lot of people saying themselves, and that's true to agree, but obviously they serve their masters. They serve the ruling class people. I mean, you know, the police, as modern police as we know them, were established in the 19th century in England to control the working class, the restless, lumpen proletariats that were, you know, threatening the established order. So that's where the modern idea of police comes from. Before that, you know, there were local, like sheriffs and beadles and all these other funny names, dealt with problems in the community, but it was, you know, obviously more a communitarian thing because they were there on the... But then the big police forces, that's when they started.
It was actually established... Julius Caesar established the first police force, or someone related to Julius Caesar.
Yes, he had. Oh, obviously, they had security forces. Yes, but as we understand it, the Metropolitan Police.
Constable.
In the modern era, yeah, the constables and all that, and the hierarchy that's been established. Yes, yeah, so, well, of course. I mean, it's all about control, isn't it? It's always been. I mean, it's part of human history, of the control of people, and we've seen a shocking example of it recently with the Sovereign Embassy protests being. Pushed out of the city, being, you know, like, apparently really roughly handled to remove them from the presence, the royal presence. I mean, if that doesn't tell you what it's all about, you know, just this, these particular people have got to be spared the sight of unruly elements, you know. I'm very sick of them.
And also around where there's been things like, well, mining. Most recently, it's the coal seam gas.
Yes, yes.
And hundreds of police. And and up in Western Australia, with the exploration and mining up there at Prince James Point, it was huge numbers of police sent in.
Yes. Controlling the money power, the people with the money, you know, give them their orders, really. I mean, sure, yeah, like on a day-to-day basis, some police do some traffic. They do useful traffic work, don't they, Linda? But anybody really can do that. And, you know, when people sometimes do sad things like jump off bridges, yes, the police have to go along and cover up the body and that and stuff like that. So obviously there are those other things that they do, but their primary focus, really, their underlying reason is to control the populace. And, you know, we have to challenge that. I mean, we can't let a return to blatant police state, you know, tactics that we've seen and we're seeing increasingly. So, and of course, we can't ignore the G20 thing, because that's going to be, oh God, I don't know what it's going to be. What do you think, Linda? Who knows? I mean, it's obviously going to be a big security thing. We've seen it, you know, all now in the media and stuff. Senior police went to Russia and that to observe their G20 preparations and everything. Maybe we have to, you know, like, put it out there that if police, you know, personally, on an individual basis, have qualms about these things. This was brought up in the Twitter thing too. Why did these individual people do it? A lot of it is security, good job, good benefits, nice uniform. But we have to challenge them. You know, like in a public forum, why are you going to, you know, do these things, suppress free speech? There are people were going on about what they could do on the Twitter thing. There were honourable exceptions. Michael Egan, I think, I'm pretty sure his name is, during the Right to March days in the 70s, a police officer in uniform threw down his hat, strode out of the police line and started pulling other police off his friend who was being arrested at a Right to March demo. Of course, he was arrested, and it was in the Courier Mail, the big picture on the paper the next day, him being arrested. Now, that was a brave act on his part. He you know, stood out of the line. It was a great morale boost for everyone. And, of course, after that, he was harassed for years and had to eventually leave the state. Also, Trish Keddie, a police officer, an Aboriginal police officer, she resigned in disgust at the death of Daniel Yock in police custody. When was that? In the 90s or something. So there are people who do the right thing, and, you know, good on them. These are real heroes.
I think talking about other places in the world, recently in Thailand, I think it was, with there was the issues there, and there was this great celebration. Oh, the police have taken off their put down their weapons. Shields and all that, but in the end, it ended up being that it was some pre-orchestrated thing where they had to do that. So,
well, just turn up, call in sick, don't go.
I think that there are occasions where police have...
I've heard rumours, yes.
Around the world where police have had a conscience and stopped doing that.
There were rumours about like that in Brisbane at the time of the civil liberties, that some of them, there was a spike in sick days. But I don't, you know, it's anecdotal.
Yes. But the police are not your friend.
When they're in that uniform and, yep. Well, shall we go to a track?
Yes.
I've got a selection here, Brisbane Security City by the Saints, and Ed Cooper played it in Rockinghurst on Saturday, and while we were in there, you know, like what was going on in the streets above us, and he said, oh, I hope you think it's worth missing the Royal Walkabout to be here, and he got a bit of a laugh at that. So anyway, Security City.
I don't want to let down my own hopes for this. that's been hidden from the public view.
And you just heard from The Saints and Security City.
Yes. And on a related topic, and that other institution, organization of control, which is very prominent, is, of course, the military. And we saw that connection with the royalty because recently the survivors or the relatives of people, of soldiers who've died in Afghanistan, were meeting the prince and princess and everything. So it's, you know, that royal connection is there. The king is traditionally the head of the military. And, of course, you know, Anzac Day is coming up and it's getting more and more prominent, especially now it's the 100 years, Linda, since World War One, and we're going to hear that now for the next 4 years. And, you know, the big Anzac thing is going on over there in Turkey and that. But even some military historians have started to say, hey, this is too much. You know, the little kiddies walking around with the medals on, it's, you know, it's all getting to be too much just of a glorification of world war, it has to be said. I mean, sure, people have suffered in that, and the soldiers and their relatives, and we could acknowledge that. But we have to maybe look at the causes for war now. Like the police, the army is supposed to protect us, but how many wars that have actually occurred that have really directly threatened the Australian populace? Well, there was World War II, wasn't there? There was Japan. We've discussed that previously. It was there were consequences, nationalism, imperialism. But most other wars Australia's participated have been in foreign fields far away. They've not directly threatened Australia. And we have just been part of the Western Alliance again and again, Britain and the United States. But this is all coming up now because I've just read a book recently.
Congratulations.
Thomas Keneally, Shame and the Captives. Now, Thomas Keneally will be known to people from Schindler's Ark, which became Schindler's List, of course, a Holocaust story and a very, very powerful book. The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith in the 70s, which was made into a movie about that other war, the war that still goes on in this country, this undeclared war of the indigenous people against the invaders. And, of course, The People's Train, which I've reviewed on the show previously, which is about Brisbane and the general strike, 1912, fighting in the streets, special constables, and a mention of anarchism in that book. Well, in this book, Shame and the Captives, which is set in World War II, he actually has an anarchist character, a young Italian prisoner of war, anarcho-syndicalist, a mechanic. And he is in the jail, the military prison in central New South Wales. It was actually Cowra. It's based on the Cowra breakout, but they've changed the names, along with a lot of Japanese prisoners of war. And of course, there was a breakout by those prisoners, and there was terrible slaughter. And it's a good book because besides him giving some sympathy, well, maybe not sympathy, maybe just justified consideration of anarchism, only briefly, but he's got an attractive character, the young guy, the young who would have been, you know, like in jail. Of course, he was a conscript. He, you know, had to go into the army, or he'd go to jail in Italy. So he chose to be a mechanic, and was captured, and then came to Australia. And he was very anti-fascist. Rather in prison here than in prison in Italy, he would say. And so that was, you know, good. I mean, it was a little bit of criticism, a little bit of, you know, like his rather simplistic or portrayed a simplistic answer was no Japan Empire, no war, because, you know, like he made that connection. But Keneally makes it sound a little simple, but still, it's a worthwhile consideration of anarchism as an alternative to militarism. But the main thing, of course, is about the Japanese prisoners. I mean, I was aware of it, but the detail that he goes into, Keneally goes into their state of mind, well, I mean, one can only suppose in a way, because of course most of them died, but they, you know, they were shamed because they'd been captured, they were supposed to die, they got sick, they got injured, they ran out of ammunition, so they got captured. So there was this seething mass of suicidal tendencies, and it really goes into that state of mind of, you know, like, why did they do it? You know, you're constantly asking yourself why. And it was the empire, you know, they saw themselves as just part of the empire, just little cogs, and they did had no existence if they felt they'd betrayed the empire by not dying on the field. And so, you know, they were going to die and take as many soldiers with them as they could. And the anarchist character, of course, this Italian prisoner of war, he was working on a farm, he was trusted, he had sympathy for one of the Japanese prisoners that he'd met, and it was very, you know, evocative, like the personal and the political coming together there. And as the Japanese prisoner is dying at the end, which is not surprising, having been shot by a farmer's wife, the anarchist Italian prisoner is there, and he's trying to wipe the blood off his face, and Keneally, in a side, says anarchist first aid. He calls it anarchist first aid, as one prisoner comforts a dying one, even though, of course, they come from the opposite sides. I mean, you know, the Italian was an anarchist, the Japanese guy was, you know, a fascist, really, basically. So it's a very moving book, and I would hardly recommend it for anyone needing something to read with a bit of politics and a bit of substance in it. But it all came down to empire, people. That's what it's all about. The British Empire, the Japanese Empire, the American Empire. You know, enough of this empires and kings and queens. Enough, I say. So anyway, the book is Shame and the Captives by Thomas Keneally. I thought we could have a going out with a appropriate song, Linda.
Yes.
The band played Waltzing Matilda. Can you...
Fantastic.
Yeah.
They'll probably be getting a few spins on Triple Z.
Oh, yeah. This is the Pogues version. The original
coming up.
The original version was by some Scottish guy who's living in Australia. I can't remember his name. But, yeah, the Pogues put a particular slant on it. You know, those young guys going over there and dying.
You're on for Triple Z. It is 12:30. Coming up soon, we're going to be hearing from the Stimulator with It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. And it includes a history of the Black Bloc.
Ah, the alternative.
Right now, we're going to be hearing the Pogues and the band played Waltzing Matilda. Thanks a lot, Peter, for coming in.
Yo.
When I was a young man, I carried my pack and I lived the free life of a rover. From the Murray's Green Basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, 'cause there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun, and they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as we sailed away from the quay. And amidst all the tears and the shouts and the cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. How well I remember that terrible day, when the blood stained the sand and the water. And how in that hell that they call Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turkey was ready, he primed himself well, he showered us with bullets and he rained us with shells. And in 5 minutes flat, he'd blown us all to hell, nearly blew us right back to Australia. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as we stop to bury our slain. And we buried ours, and the Turks buried theirs, and it started all over again. Now those who were living did their best to survive in that mad world of death, blood and fire. And for 7 long weeks I kept myself alive, though the corpses around me piled higher. Then a big Turkish shell knocked me arse over tip, and when I awoke in my hospital bed and saw what it had done, Christ, I wished I was dead. Never knew there were worse things than dying. And no more I'll go on, sing Matilda, to the green bushes so far and near, for to hang tens and pegs, a man needs 2 legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. Collected the cripples, the wounded and maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The legless, the armless, the blind and insane, those proud wounded heroes of Sofla. And as our ship pulled into Circular Quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thank Christ there was nobody waiting for me to grieve and to mourn and to pity. And the band played waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway, but nobody cheered, they just stood and stared, and they turned their faces away. And now every April I sit on my porch and I watch the parade pass before me. I see my own comrades, how proudly they march, reliving the dreams of past glory. I see the old men, all twisted and torn, the forgotten heroes of a forgotten war. And the young people ask me, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. And the band plays waltzing Matilda, and the old men still answer the call. But year after year their numbers get fewer, someday no one will march there at all.
on 4ZZZ 102.1 FM. And you just heard from the Pogues and the band played Waltzing Matilda. We're going to hear now the latest episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine by The Stimulator. And this requires a language and concept warning. And it's interesting that we're playing this because there's this big fear and hype in the media about the Black Bloc and the G20 that we've been talking about. So I'm sure the police will be listening intently to this.
This episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine was made possible by contributions from slaves like you. Spanky very much.
A lot of people involved in the Black Bloc on Saturday, many of them 6 months ago, were members of the Labour Party, working for the Liberal Democrat Party, people who really believed back then that parliamentary democracy could work for them, and now they believe that it's not going to work for them.
It's the end of the world as we know it, I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, the show where all our heroes wear masks.
Go ninja, go ninja, go! 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 Go, 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 go!
I am your host, The Stimulator, and with global May Day protests and the Occupy wave of actions coming up, I thought it would be nice to do a little segment about the tactic of tactics. The cancer in Chris Hedges' colon.
Too big to fail, big enough to fall.
The most widespread and mimicked street formation of the last 6,000 years.
Okay.
And the craze that has police departments and politicians wetting their dockers. Yep.
The Black Bloc.
But what about Madrid?
You're right, agitator. I must first pay my respects to our lion-hearted peeps in Madrid who daringly attacked the fuzz during anti-austerity protests last month.
Underpinnings of this movement are confrontational and radical.
Many people out there think that the Black Bloc is a gang or crew that one can join.
The radical group called the Black Bloc anarchists openly brag about using terrorist-type tactics.
There are no Black Bloc anarchists, you dick-nosed shit rocket. The Black Bloc is simply a fucking tactic.
Black Bloc is not a group or a social movement. It's simply a tactic used by protesters to protect themselves from police aggression and express a complete rejection of capitalism.
Tactics are techniques used for securing objectives and are part of a strategy or plan of action.
Like the tactic of blockading a street. The blockade is used with the objective of stopping police or industry traffic into an area that you are trying to hold or protect, and could be part of an overall strategy to protect a forest or autonomous zone, for example. The Black Bloc tactic can be used for the purpose of securing streets, with the strategic goal of creating autonomous spaces for dissent within the context of intense police repression. It can also be used to attack corporate and state infrastructure, allowing the saboteurs to remain anonymous. This tactic has spread around the world like wildfire, and we have witnessed its prowess in places such as Turkey, Egypt, Brazil, and Colombia. So, to find out more about the history of the Black Bloc, I bring you Francis Dupuy-Dery, a motherfucking anarchist and author of Who's Afraid of the Black Blocs? Hey Francis, how the fuck are you?
I don't know.
When was the tactic of Black Bloc first deployed?
The Black Bloc, the way we know it, appeared the first time in Germany, in West Berlin, at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. The first time the term Black Bloc was coined in Germany was in 1980. And it was in the what was called at the time the Autonomen movement, a movement mainly of squatters, political squatters, were involved in a protest against the nuclear industries, the nuclear weapons, and the neo-fascist movement in Germany. So at the time in Germany, they were wearing a leather jacket. That was what was fashionable at the time. So black leather jacket, black motorcycle helmet, and they were merging in black block to get a mass of anonymous people, because you can't recognize people in a homogeneous mass of people wearing black and mask. And they were using this tactic to confront the police, fight against the police which was coming to expose them from their squats, for instance, or to fight against neo-Nazis in the streets.
In the description of your book, Who's Afraid of the Black Blocs, it states that the image of the window-smashing thug hides a complex reality. Can you fucking explain?
Too often the black bloc is described by politicians, by police officers, by journalists, by scholars, even as something really not interesting from a political point of view. They are described as a bunch of hooligans and as apolitical individuals who just like to riot, like to smash things without any political rational.
The black bloc, which are, you know, primarily white, sort of nihilistic, destructive, you know, embracing sort of confusing petty vandalism and this repellent sort of cynicism with revolution.
And of course, when you listen to them, when you watch them in action, when you look at them, when you follow them, and when you try to understand what they do in Germany, in France, in Great Britain, in Greece, in Brazil, you rapidly understand that it's only about politics.
I heard 50,000 other people were going to be here, and I figured even if they're out here protesting in a way that I don't like, advocating reform or abolition of some particular institution, at least there are 50,000 people that really care and are worked up about something, and hopefully we can come out here and give them a shove in a little more radical direction.
About politics, about economics, of course, also, about power relationship, about domination, and it's a way to express a radical criticism of these systems, the state system, the capitalist system, the bank system, and their targets. What the target is the message. It's what they target that give us the meaning of their action.
Thanks, Francis. Stay tuned after the break for an interview with a Montreal street fighter.
Sortir du silence comme d'un abcès, trouver l'écho, laisser la folie exploser. Ignorer la voix, aller droite à l'opposé, compter parler le fractal. Le rouge, parce que le bleu me rend malade. Un rouge profond et dense à la mesure de la primade. Alerte rouge, parce que le rose est bien trop fade. Mais rouge comme la couleur des théâtres et barricades. Car s'ils savaient ce que je pense de leur mode d'emploi, leur façon de nous la faire à l'enfer et à l'endroit, leur fin sera mon début, c'est bien normal qu'on reste en froid. Je crache mes brûlots de brûlots, puis disparais après l'envoi. Et j'attends le sabotage, je décrypte la machine, l'imprévu, le coup du sort. Faire valser le décor, je veux dégraisser le port, puis redresser les chines, inverser la vapeur et voir la peur changer de bord.
Viewers of this fucking show know that in 2012, thousands of people took part in a six-month insurrection in Montreal. What is popularly known as the Maple Spring began as a student strike, but evolved into a popular revolt that included many sectors of society. The sheer fucking number of protesters and the non-stop use of militant street tactics exhausted not only the cops, but also their budget. Since then, the Montreal Popo have smartened up and have consistently kettled anti-capitalist demonstrations as a way to avoid a repeat of 2012. This year, comrades have been having conversations as to how to regain the street power that was obtained on that insurrectionary moment. So, to revisit some of the tactics used in the battles of that year, I bring you Nick, a university student involved in much of the street fighting in 2012. But first, a fucking disclaimer.
The voice of Nick has been replaced with that of a voice actor to protect their identity. Also, some of the footage used to illustrate Nick's experience will not necessarily be from Montreal. this video is meant for entertainment purposes only, much like a sex toy or a novelty whoopee cushion.
So, enough of that noise. Hey, Nick, how the fuck are you?
I'm feeling great.
So, how the fuck does street fighting progress in Montreal?
From the beginning of the strike, we saw the use of masks go from being an isolated practice to something that became normal for hundreds of people to do. This explosion in the use of masks wasn't magical. It took anarchists consistently masking up and explaining why they mask up in flyers and conversations. The same can be said for attacks against police. As the strike progressed, the isolated attacks on police that characterized the demos during the beginning of the strike, such as a couple of rocks thrown in their direction, eventually became more popular to do, up to the point where demos sometimes became very uncontrollable for hours. This was simply a matter of persistence.
Fuck!
As people continued to see masked up street fighters getting away with attacking the pigs who had been clubbing them for weeks, they started to see themselves as capable of acting conflictually as well. I imagine that this involved many different groups of friends in the student milieu making plans to come to demos with these intentions for the first time, but also probably involved many people coming by themselves. The tension that could be felt against the police during the strike initially mostly only manifested itself in chants, but over time this transformed into the more empowering practice of attacking police directly. And as more and more people took this up, it snowballed into being normalized.
And what are some of the tactical lessons learned from that period?
When we look at the confrontation with police that we've seen here, it can basically be broken down into two things. Confrontation that frees up space from the police, and confrontation that doesn't have the force to make police retreat, but is still valuable, obviously. From what I've seen, the factors that make projectile attacks, for instance, capable of winning the space, are coordination and widespread participation, with an offensive mentality that doesn't wait for police to attack us first. This is how fear changes camps, avoiding the cycle of police inevitably attacking the demo and dispersing it as everyone runs from police charges. In Montreal, the courage to confront police is already held by many people, but often the level of self-organization is not quite developed enough to make these confrontations long-lasting. Something that some anarchists quickly realized was that if we want to hold the streets after things start to get wild, projectiles must be collected as soon as possible. During the demos with a more militant tone, like March 15th, the night demos, the book fair weekend, April 25th, May Day, and others, within the first 10 minutes you would see crews running into alleys or gardens to collect rocks inside bags, or using hammers to ply rocks up from the street, or smashing the larger pieces into throwable sizes on the sidewalk. People who had collected rocks would then distribute them amongst the masked portion of the demo. Something that also started to happen more often was people counting down before throwing, so that instead of just one or two rocks actually connecting with police, there were volleys that could make police retreat. Another tactic to accompany rock throwing that has been used pretty extensively is throwing paint bombs, but these often have a limited effect unless aimed well enough to hit a visor. I've seen this happen only once. Fire extinguishers filled with paint, on the other hand, as seen in Oakland during the general strike, are the perfect weapon against police. With one swoosh, you can blind an entire riot cop line and take them out for as long as it takes them to clear their visors. The same goes for police vehicle front windshields. Fireworks are also often shot at police lines, but the few times boat flares have been used, they have been far more effective than fireworks. It's also really important for undercovers and corporate media to be fought out of the demo as soon as things start to get rowdy, to make it safer to eventually disperse and demask. And finally, wearing black socks over shoes and ditching them with everything else can save you a lot of trouble. So can wearing cotton gloves. Yep, that's about it.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for this edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. As always, this here labor of love and rage is brought to you by slaves who share their fiat currency so that we can keep the lights on. So muchas motherfucking gracias to Jason, Samantha, Katie, Kalen, Fiona, Regina, Danielle, Patrick, Miguel, Gavin, Adrian, Tim, Angela, Thomas, Preston Productions, Rosemary, Tom, Alexander, Gregory, One Brain, Jimmy, Dylan, Christian, Kyle, Valentin, Francois, Alyssa, Jennifer, Liam, Richard, Justin, James, Robin, Chris, Aaron, Micah, Stephen, Sean, Serena, Patrick, Limelum, FG, Bruce, and Stephen. Pozole. I also want to give a warm welcome to the newest members of the Ta Conspiracy, Ashley, Amelia, and Justine. Bienvenidas. For links to information about militant street tactics, just visit my fucking website, stimulator.tv. And to quote from Sun Tzu's The Art of War, the ultimate skill is to take up a position where you are formless. If you are formless, the most penetrating spies will not be able to discern you, or the wisest counsels will not be able to do calculations against you. See you in the streets. La peur changer de bord, urgent, crier.
right into this after this very, very important message. So listen very carefully.
Anarchism is not bombs, disorder, or chaos. It is not robbery or murder. It is not a war of each against all. Anarchism is the very opposite of all that. Find out for yourself. Tune in to the 4ZZZ Anarchy Show on Monday from 12 to 1pm.
The end of the show. You just heard from The Great Shame and Police State. And The Great Shame is the name of a book by Thomas Keneally. Linking in.
Good segue. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I forgot that one. Yeah. I mean, I haven't read all of his stuff or anything. But as an antidote to all this, you know, oppression stuff, people, you can remember, you can be glad that May Day is coming up. Hooray. Also known as Labor Day. There's no public holiday since the LNP government changed it to rationalise it to the same as the southern states. But in Queensland, we still march. We did last year on the Sunday nearest to the 1st of May, and that will be the 4th. Of May, and the march gathers in just around here, actually, in Spring Hill, and goes to the RNA and, you know, and the unions and everything. But there's also a healthy presence of alternative people. Not just, you don't just have to be a union member. Any worker or any claimant or anybody with something to say can turn up, and there will be an anarchist presence there. So keep that in mind. The 4th of May, starting about 10 or 11, depends when the ALP leaders turn up before we can
start marching. And there's always a bit of controversy, Linda. There's always some controversy, like the Catters Australia Party turned up one year and there was all this sneering going on between the leftists and them. Yes, it's like that. We were all a bit shocked. And also heckling about the carbon tax. And, oh, there's always something, you know, abortion rights, land rights, everything. It's a long history. So you could participate in that. But before that, there's going to be a gig at Turnstile, at Laura Street, Highgate Hill, on the 1st itself, which I think is a Thursday, not this week, but the week after, the 1st of May at Turnstile. I don't know when it's starting. I don't even know who's on, but it'll be a gig.
So 10 Laura Street, Highgate Hill.
Yeah, the 1st of May.
Also, next week's looking pretty busy. On the 2nd of May, there's going to be a counter-protest against a protest organised by the Australia First Party. March and rally with local supporters of the Greek neo-Nazi organisation Golden Dawn.
Ooh.
So they're planning to assemble at the Greek Club. Although the Greek Club, I think, is trying to distance itself or is not interested or something officially. And then they're going to march to the Greek Consulate, which is level 36 Central Plaza 1 in Queen Street. They're holding a picket.
The Greek Club is in West End, of course, just near Musgrave Park.
Edmondson Street, 29 Edmondson Street.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to hold a picket between 1 and 4 p.m. at the Central Plaza, Queen Street, in support of Golden Dawn, because some members of the Golden Dawn Party in Greece have been jailed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they're being tried too for murder and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And, wow, well, then so Australia First. What was the micro-party name?
The Australia First Party.
God.
Yeah, they're kind of white supremacists.
Yes,
and people scary
anti-immigrationists, and that's what I saw something on the TV about the Golden Dawn. They had a Greek Australian from Melbourne there, you know, supporting them. But hang on, he's an immigrant, isn't he? You know, a Greek Australian by definition, an immigrant. And they are, you know, this is a country with a lot of immigrants, and they, you know, they're going on about all the bloody immigrants. Hypocrisy.
Well, that's what it's all about.
Yes.
And they say racism is just a lack of education and knowledge. We're going to go out with a song from Promo. It's called Murder Murdoch.
Visions of bullets ripping through flesh. I'm itching to pull it, man, isn't it fresh? To his eardrums where I put it, like, listen to this.
Blah.
Mission accomplished, LOL.
Cause it wasn't complicated at all. Still my accomplished, wishing that he'd never gotten involved. Cause now we all have a Fox News. They spread propaganda that's not true, saying some Arabic terrorists did it. Fuck you! I did it and I take full responsibility. It was self-defense, like a proof that he was killing me. New shit, I'm shooting at my enemies and keep doing it by any means. Because my space is time wasted, I'm wasted. Can't take it any further, word up. More hits is more ads, is more shit, that's more cash. That's why I wanna murder, My space is time wasted, I'm wasted. Blaze the fire, let your burners burn up. More friends, give more ends, there's no end, it's dope, man. That's why I wanna murder,
Group of shooting, group it over music like asthma. Produce it in fast moves, that's stupid, that's equivalent. Catching some bruises, multiple stab wounds, electrocution, a massive confusion. Here's my confession, but you can't even prove it. When I load up the German Luger, what's my motive to murder Rupert? I'ma tell you what the truth is, you ain't putting up with no excuses.
No,
it's not cause he own 99% of all media. That's not why he dying, lying on the floor, bleeding now. It's not cause I might believe that he's a part of the conspiracy. That I hate Fox News interviews they distribute from off my TV screen. But I hold him responsible for killing my creativity.
Yeah.
And without my creativity, y'all, I ain't really me. My space is time wasted, I'm wasted. Can't take it any further, word up. More hits is more ads, is more shit, that's more cash. That's why I wanna murder. My space is time
certain what exactly is he trying to promote. Man, I wanna murder. How can that peace, love, and rapper promo turn so violent? What has happened? Why he's so provoked? All of a sudden, what exactly is he trying to promote? Oh no, this ain't a friend request. I post a bulletin, put a gun to his chest, unload some bullets in. So many profile views, but from my point of view, it ain't my space, it's his face. Shut down the bitrate on that shit face.
As a company, we have an absolute commitment to the principle of action on climate change. We're very proud of our values.
But as one of the major contributors to CO2 emissions, and as we begin to contend with the real-world effects of climate change, we have to prepare ourselves for the next step in addressing our corporate responsibilities in this area.
While the steps on the surface seem to be in opposition to our self-interest, the reality is, however, that they are actually in opposition to our self-interest.
So we recognise what we call the gap.
The gap is the problem of simultaneously holding two contradictory positions.
On one hand, to act on our responsibility to humanity, but on the other hand, to deliver on our commitment to superior value for our shareholders.
We needed to take a leap of faith.
An intuitive step outside of the limitations of science-based argument.
I'm proud to announce the company's new policy of fuck you. Fuck you is more than a policy. It's a philosophy where we're able to straddle the dichotomy between what we know is true and how we can benefit by ignoring that truth.
Fuck you means we can be passionate about our values, but not act on them.
Fuck you takes what would be our present-day financial burden away from us and transforms it into a chronic, economic, social, cultural, and political crisis for future generations.
The genius of this, however, is that we transferred it away from us.
It ensures solid returns to our shareholders by killing their grandchildren.
With this policy, we delay action and leverage the gap and are able to maintain our role as a global leader in destroying the planet.
Ultimately, this is a reflection of the values of our shareholders. Everyday Australians have chosen to invest $20 billion into the company, but we prefer to think of it as 20 billion fuck yous to the Australians of tomorrow.
There will come a day when my moral choices will no longer be beholden to the shareholders, and a wave of profound regret and a sorrow will engulf me as I realise with painful clarity the enormity of the damage I have perpetrated upon humanity. And even if I plead with whoever has succeeded my role in the company to stop putting CO2 in the air for the sake of my daughter's grandchildren, he or she can turn to me and simply respond with, fuck you. And that legacy really does make me very proud.
That was called Australians for Coal, What is Your Investment Dollar Doing? And you can find that on YouTube. search for Australians for Coal, and also you could look at a website called www.pushyourparents.org, and the person who uploaded that video is Yiannis Nikolopoulos, and that is spelt Nikolakopoulos. So it might be easier to search for Australians for Coal, what is your investment dollar doing?
You've been listening to Autonomous Action Radio on Z Digital. For more information about the show, you can go to autonomousactionradio.com or 4ZZZFM.org.au.
For fraud, stealing, and larceny, and all other crimes involving property. For it's nothing.